I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, Books on Trees. With us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Dennis Minsky, naturalist on the Dolphin Whale Watch and member of the Provincetown Tree Advisory Group. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Mindy. Good morning, Jill.
Yeah. We're at Provincetown Tree Advisory Group. Jill, we hadn't heard about that before, so tell us what that is.
Well, it is Provincetown last year passed a local bylaw protecting all the trees in town along the public ways. And associated with that is an advisory group. We are led by Margaret Murphy, who also recommended some of these books to me today. She's a wonderful leader. So we are at the policy-making stage of things. So we're hoping to save as many trees as we can for reasons that you will hear about this hour.
Yeah, and so this idea of books on trees, Jill, was your idea. And did you have any idea that we'd find so many books in this topic?
I can say I did not. I knew that we were having a lot of trees. I was noticing there were a lot of tree books coming into the library and that it might be an interesting topic. But when you start thinking about trees, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And not only trees about the history of trees, but then you get into fairy tales and trees and novels that have great scenes from trees and Shakespeare and trees. And it gets bigger and bigger. So it has been a real adventure in trying to cull down the number of books. Dennis and I have both arrived with large piles, which we will probably not have time for all that we have brought with us.
Table is full. All right. So what's the first book?
Well, the first thing I'd like to start with is actually a poem, and it is a short poem by William Carlos Williams. It seems appropriate both for the fact that it's called Winter Trees and that it has a moon in it, which we are under a full moon today, a blue moon even. It's called Winter Trees by William Carlos Williams. All the complicated details of the attiring and the disattiring are completed. A liquid moon moves gently among the long branches. Thus, having prepared their buds against a sure winter, the wise trees stand sleeping in the cold.
Nice.
And I'm actually a big fan of winter trees. I love looking at the branches. I think the trees are so interesting. And
especially when you look up at them
this time
in the full moon.
Absolutely. Or early in the morning, like sunset, sunrise, beautiful images of trees.
Right. Dennis.
Well, I'll match you a poem. I'll start with a poem. It is entitled Lost. It's by a man named David Wagoner, who was a prominent poet and novelist of the Pacific Northwest. Stand still. The trees ahead and the bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here, and you must treat it as a powerful stranger, must ask permission to know it and be known. The forest breathes. Listen. It answers. I have made this place around you. You can leave and return again simply by saying here. No two trees are the same to raven. No two branches are the same to wren. Wherever you are, if what a tree or a bush does for you is lost, then you are surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you.
You know, say you memorize that.
That's very
pretty impressive.
Yeah,
exactly.
Mostly.
Mostly. All right. First book, Jill.
All right. So I brought a book called The Long, Long Life of Trees by Fiona Stafford. And it got a rave review from Margaret Drabble, of a novelist I like very much. So I thought, well, I'll look into this. And in fact, it is a beautiful book in and of itself. It is filled with beautiful illustrations, and she takes a series of trees and different kinds of trees and talks about them. And there are some very funny things about this book, which is part of what is so great about it, is that it teaches you more than you could possibly know about any kind of tree. She examines the cultural associations of 17 types of trees with humankind through literature, history, mythology, folklore, commerce, fine art, music, pop culture, and science. In the author's words, this is a personal exploration of the meaning of trees. And she has a great little section about January trees, which begins, "A January morning can be the best time of all for seeing trees, because it is when the leaves have been stripped away entirely that the graceful symmetry of an alder or the wispy cascade of a silver birch is clearest. It is easier to spot things that are normally hidden away, too. Last year's nest of tangled sticks blotting the line of an upper branch, or an outcrop of creamy fungus, like a stand of ghostly parasols at the foot of a nettle-free trunk. Even when the day is drenched in gray and there's hardly anything to be seen, the ashes will still be brandishing their black buds as if pointing towards some higher region of color and light." And I love that idea of all you can see, everything that becomes obvious once the trees drop. And you do see all kinds of nests that you would not see otherwise. So that is quite interesting. She also has a little section on celebrity trees, which includes, and this again is the great thing about doing this show, I had never heard of the Endicott pear tree before. Have either of you ever heard of the Endicott? It is one of the oldest trees in Massachusetts and still alive after nearly 400 years. It's just outside of Salem. So she mentions some trees retain their celebrity status, not as witnesses to something, but as seedlings of someone. On the South Lawn at the White House, there is magnolia planted by President Andrew Jackson, and in Massachusetts, an even more venerable pear tree, which was set by the first governor of the state, John Endicott. Although one of the odd things about that great pear tree is now it's they have a little fence around it, but in fact, it is all buildings and offices and so forth. There's no longer an actual farm there. And one of the funniest things talked about in a review of this book was one way of responding to this marvelous book is to keep reading aloud to one's patiently exasperated partner. "You didn't know this, and nor did I. You didn't know and are glad to know that extract of horse chestnut has been used to cure arachnophobia, that the archery regiment at Agincourt lived in fear of poisoning by its own longbows." So there are many different aspects of trees in here. There's a beautiful section on Thomas Hardy's novel called The Woodlanders. And after reading this description of it, it made me want to go, I have yet to read The Woodlanders, but it sounds like an amazing book. And of course, even Harry Potter shows up in here because of his willow tree.
Romping willow, yeah.
Exactly. And so there's a whole section on, for those of you that love Harry Potter, you will also find Harry Potter in The Long, Long Life of Trees by Fiona Stafford.
All right. Thank you, Jill. Dennis.
Yeah, I just want to say before I start that, as you both mentioned, I have a stack of books here. For every book I mention, there's another one I couldn't mention. A friend of mine, Susan Lyman, an artist, recommended lent me a lot of beautiful photography and art books, which are a little hard to discuss, but I will put them on our list. So my first book is Peter Wohlleben, a German man, and the title is The Hidden Life of Trees, What They Feel, How They Communicate. Now, the last time I was here, I talked about The Genius of Birds by Jennifer Ackerman. I think you might have even had her on the show.
Yeah, that was a great book.
Yeah. Well, this book is like that. Mm-hmm. This is mind-blowing. You will never think about trees the same way. Peter Wohlleben is not a scientist. He's a forester. But for every statement he makes, he backs it up with a scientific paper in the index. So this is what he says. Trees experience pain, have memories, parents live together with their children and nurse them, trees help their neighbors, they are reluctant to abandon their dead, he talks about fatalities and corpses, there are connections, affection, friendship, partners, buddies, mind-blowing. And as I say, he backs all that up. Why are trees so connected? Because they need each other. On its own, a tree cannot establish a consistent local climate. It's at the mercy of wind and weather. But together, many trees create an ecosystem that moderates extremes of heat and cold, stores a great deal of water, and generates a great deal of humidity. He also goes on to say, he talks about scientists have measured that the rate of photosynthesis in a forest of trees is constant. Each tree has the same level. Now, this is surprising because they grow in different places mm-hmm. with different regimes. But what they're doing is the stronger trees are helping the weaker trees, believe it or not.
Ooh, wow.
That's what the results are so astounding. The rate of photosynthesis is the same for all trees. There is obviously a lively exchange going on. Their enormous networks act as a giant redistribution mechanism, shades of Bernie Sanders. It's a bit like the way social security systems operate to ensure individual members of society don't fall too far behind. How do they do this? When you look at a tree, large as it is, what's underground is twice as large. The root system of a tree is twice as large. So the roots of a tree extend and they intertwine beneath the ground, and they are intertwined. Beyond the roots, there are soil fungi who are symbiotic, and they too, he refers to them as fiber optic cables. So it's called the wood wide web. Terrible pun. And I just want to read one last thing. A lot of American trees were taken over to Europe. I'll get to that later, too. He mentions that the giant redwoods in Europe from America do not prosper. They don't grow so tall. Why? Why? Because I'm trying to find that place. They missed their parents. They don't have siblings. They've lost the means to communicate. They have no support system. Mm. It's mind-boggling.
When you said that the branches, you know, under the ground, kind of, all I can think of, it's like holding hands, right? The trees are holding hands.
Yes.
Yep. I mean, finally, he says, so what do we do about this now that we find out the trees? He says, that means it's okay to use wood as long as trees are allowed to live in a way that is appropriate to their species. And that means they should be allowed to fulfill their social needs, to grow in a true forest environment on undisturbed ground, and to pass their knowledge on to the next generation. And at least some of them should be allowed to grow old with dignity and finally die a natural death.
Wow, interesting.
This is a mind-boggling book.
Yeah, and that is The Hidden Life of Trees, What They Feel, How They Connect by Peter Woolman.
Woolman.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to add a book to our list about trees. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books on trees with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Dennis Minsky, naturalist on the Dolphin Whale Watch Tours and a member of the Provincetown Tree Advisory Group. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to suggest a book for our book list. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill.
Well, one of the things I started thinking about when putting together this show was about fairy tales and all of the forests and woods that appear in fairy tales. And it turns out I'm not the only one that has put those two things together. And there is a whole book called From the Forest, A Search for the Hidden Roots of Our Fairy Tales by Sarah Maitland. And interestingly, when this book first came out in England, it was called Gossip from the Forest, not From the Forest. I don't know why the American publisher decided they didn't want the word gossip in the title, but it is now called From the Forest. And over a course of a year, Maitland explores a series of 12 forests, but she also creates stories to retelling of fairy tales after each forest that she visits. And of course, she's going with all of these various forests with other people. As Publishers Weekly wrote in this lovely inventive book, Maitland pursues the psychic juncture between forests and fairy tales. Each chapter begins with a walk taken by Maitland in a northern European forest and an essay in which she deftly juggles ecological history, the anthropology of woodland, and fairy tales. Each alternating chapter is the retelling of a fairy tale. And she makes some sort of interesting decisions when she retells these fairy tales. Hansel and Gretel become middle-aged. Rumpelstiltskin tells his side of the story. So they're sort of retellings of classic fairy tales. But she also writes about European fairy stories and what you find in those stories. And she writes, and one of the central aspects of the Northern European fairy story is that it takes place in the forest. It is surprising how seldom this is noticed. When I have discussed my book with other people, even experts, they have expressed surprise at my claim that the forest is of primary importance in these tales. But in fact, over half the stories, 116 out of 210 in the 1857 edition, explicitly mention forests as the locations of some part of the story, and at least another 26 have very clear forest themes or images. And she also says the fairy stories teach us how to see the forests and how to love them too. They are spooky but special in our imaginations. Woods are part of our fantasy of childhood because of the fairy stories. That love protects our woodlands. So a very interesting approach to fairy tales and to forests. And it will make you want. In fact, a lot of these books I looked at seem to be about these huge ancient forests in the UK. And this one, too, will make you want to start planning your trip so that you can walk into some of these really ancient forests. She says stories and woodland are alike in a particular way. They are specific. Stories have lots of things in common with other stories, but they are different from every other story. Woods are the same. Of course, they have things in common, but each wood is different too. And again, she tells a story of very different woods during the course of this 1 year that she's going through researching this book.
All right, let's talk to Georgia, who's from Marston's Mills, but she's listening online in Delaware this morning. Hi, Georgia.
Good morning. This one is for Jill as a small thank you for all the wonderful recommendations you have made to us over the years. It is called Trees in a Winter Landscape by Alice Upham Smith. It is a wonderful book. They're all silhouettes that she has drawn in the book. It's an old book. It may not be in print, but I think I can find our copy if you can't find it. And when we come back to the Cape in June, I'll be glad to come to Falmouth to share it with you.
Aww. Well, thank you so much. And I will certainly this afternoon go take a look and see if I can find a copy of that book. Yeah. I really appreciate that.
Georgia, thanks for calling and thanks for listening.
Yes. Take care.
Sure. Bye. And Denya sends us a note. She says, I highly recommend At the Edge of the Orchard by Tracy Chevalier. It's a rich family drama that begins around 18. Oh, you have it. You have it. Okay. It's focused on the family's relationship with apples, redwoods, and sequoias. I listened to the audiobook and was mesmerized. You want to say anything else about it?
It's on my list. But not next.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, and there's another email, which I think all of what these are on your list as well. This is from Tom in Chatham, and he says, the first and absolutely most important is American Canopy, Trees, Forests, and the Making of a Nation by Eric Rutlow, a superb history of the U.S. through the commercial value of trees. The second, you already talked about, the hidden life of trees, what they feel, how they connect. And the third, I don't think is on your list, not particular to trees, is Founding Gardens by Andrea Wolfe. She also wrote The Invention of Nature. So those are some suggestions from
Tom.
Yeah,
Andrea Wolfe's good. Yeah. It's Eric Rutko, and that is on my list.
All right, so what's next?
My next book, of course, has to be Thoreau, Henry David, 200 years anniversary last year. So I'm basing what I say now on two books. The first is a beautiful little book called Thoreau and the Language of Trees that my friend Jeanette lent me. It's by Richard Higgins, who, by the way, is going to be on Cape Cod at some point. And he has based this primarily on the essays and on Thoreau's journals, which, by the way, are in 14 volumes, totaling 2 million words. So I have Thoreau and the Language of Trees, and then Thoreau's complete essays annotated, reviewed by our own Robert Finch. So what I want to say, we think about Thoreau living in the bounty of the pre-industrial age. In fact, he witnessed deforestation, and it very much upset him. In the mid-19th century, things were going great guns. He said, thank God they cannot cut down the clouds. He was kind of an ornery guy. He said, a town is saved not more by the righteous men in it than by the woods and swamps that surround it. It's in one of my favorite essays called Walking. He said, in a town lacking trees, there will be, quote, the most starved and bigoted religionists, whatever they are, and the most desperate drinkers. We know what they are. So the three essays that I'm talking about are Wild Apples, Autumnal Hints, which was his very last, and An Address on the Succession of Forest Trees, which was his most popular essay. And he, by the way, was the first person to use the term succession in forests. Thoreau was. So the beauty of Thoreau, and I will never be done with Thoreau, is that he combined a scientific approach with a spiritual and analytical one. He really, really did investigate trees. Just one small example. I have counted in one heap, within a diameter of 4 feet, the cores of 239 pitch pine cones, which had been cut off and stripped by the red squirrel the previous winter. So he wasn't just out there whistling Dixie. He was doing work. And by the way, he died at a fairly young age from tuberculosis, but it was brought on by a severe cold that he got out in the rain counting rings on trees, aging trees. So he was a scientist, but he also, Higgins says, Thoreau knew that readers will care about a particular tree than about trees in general, more about the Davis elm, another famous tree, than about the generic elm in the Audubon Field Book. So he talks about, listen to what he says about, this is an Autumnal Hints, about falling leaves, how beautifully they go to their graves, how gently lay themselves down and turn to mold. They that soared so loftily, how contentedly they return to dust again and are laid low, resigned to lie and decay at the foot of the tree and afford nourishment to new generations of their kind as well as to flutter on high. They teach us how to die. He says, men obey their call and go to the stove-warmed church, though God exhibits himself to the walker in a frosted bush today as much as in a burning one to Moses of old. And finally, about the scrub oak that we have here on Cape Cod, he says, rigid as iron, clean as the atmosphere, hardy as virtue, innocent and sweet as a maiden is the shrub oak. In proportion as I know and love it, I am natural and sound as a partridge. I felt a positive yearning toward one bush this afternoon. There was a match found for me at last. I fell in love with a shrub oak. So he combines the spiritual and the scientific, and he did never marry, by the way. So.
We're going from Thoreau to John Muir. And John Muir, for those of you that don't know, made himself America's most eloquent spokesman for the mystery and majesty of the wilderness. Library of America actually has put out a beautiful volume of his nature writings. And we could not be talking about this at a better time. He was very instrumental in setting up National Forest and the National Park. And he wrote this beautiful essay in 1897 about the American forests, the first line of which is, the forests of America, however slighted by man, must have been a great delight to God, for they were the best he ever planted. The whole continent was a garden, and from the beginning it seemed to be favored above all the other wild parks and gardens of the globe. And he ends this essay, which is all a plea to save trees and wilderness. And he says, Any fool can destroy trees. They cannot run away, and if they could, they would still be destroyed, chased and hunted down as long as fun or a dollar could be got out of their back hides, branching horns, or magnificent bull backbones. Few that fell trees plant them, nor would planting avail much towards getting back anything like the noble primeval forests. During a man's life, only saplings can be grown in the place of the old trees, tens of centuries old, that have been destroyed. It took more than 3,000 years to make some of the trees in these western woods, trees that are still standing in perfect strength and beauty, waving and singing in the mighty forests of the Sierra. Through all the wonderful, eventful centuries since Christ's time and long before that, God has cared for these trees, saved them from drought, disease, avalanches, and 1,000 straining, leveling tempests and floods. But he cannot save them from fools. Only Uncle Sam can do that. So a beautiful collection of his pieces on nature and trees. It is just called Muir's Nature Writings. Beautiful book and beautiful writings.
Right. Dennis, what's next?
Well, I will talk about At the Edge of the Orchard because Tracy Chevalier, she wrote Girl with a Pearl Earring. You might know her. And it is an amazing novel. I'll read from the book flap. 1838, James and Sadie Goodenough have settled where their wagon got stuck in the muddy, stagnant swamps of northwest Ohio. They and their five children work relentlessly to tame their patch of land, buying saplings from a local tree man known as John Appleseed, so they can cultivate the 50 apple trees required to stake their claim on the property. And it goes on. 1853, their youngest child, Robert, is wandering through Gold Rush, California, restless and haunted by the broken family he left behind. He has made his way alone across the country. In the redwood and giant sequoia groves, he finds some solace collecting seeds for a naturalist who sells plants from the New World to the gardeners of England. This is a historical novel. It's based on a lot of true characters, plus one made up that I can't wait to tell you about. But it just really describes the struggle that our antecedents went through. Upon settling in the Black Swamp, the first thing the Goodenoughs had done after building a rough cabin close to the Portage River was to clear land for the orchard so as to plant John Chapman's apple seed saplings. Every oak, every hickory, every elm he cut down was an agony of effort. It was hard enough to chop up and haul the trunk and branches to set aside for firewood or for making bed frames or chairs or wheels or coffins. But extracting the stumps and roots almost killed him each time he hacked and dug and pulled and ground. Prying out a stump reminded him of how deeply a tree clung to the ground, how tenacious a hold it had on a place. Though he was not a sentimental man, he did not cry when his children died, five of them. He simply dug the graves and buried them. James was silent each time he killed a tree, thinking of its time spent in that spot. But you know what was so much fun? Reading the acknowledgments, and there are historical characters here. Johnny Appleseed, this English guy who came over and collected trees, which was a really big deal. The English, the French, the Dutch, the Germans, they were in love with American trees. And tens of thousands of trees. But there's one minor character in here, the landlady. This has nothing to do with trees. She's a landlady. Her name was Dodie Bienenstock. So in the acknowledgments, Tracy writes, Dodie Bienenstock exists even today. Her daughter bought her the privilege of having a character named after her at an auction to raise funds for Freedom from Torture, a UK charity that provides treatment and rehab for survivors of torture. Dodie, we need more landladies like you. I just thought it was such a great idea for a famous writer to auction off a character. Wouldn't you like to have your name in a book like that?
I guess it depends on the author, right?
Yeah,
but I just have to say, and the listener who called in, this book I didn't get to. He talks about apples. You will learn so much about apples, every variety, every way of growing them, grafting, the process of grafting one type of apple to another, the argument of seedlings versus saplings versus so on and so forth. This is real. But what you come away from was how brutal life was back then. And the forests were tough adversaries.
Right. Jill.
Well, I was thinking a lot about what novels include scenes, great scenes from with apples, with fruit, or with trees. And I was talking to Brian Engels at the Coffee Obsession, getting my morning coffee from Brian. Brian, I know, Mindy, you know he is a local author, as well as a guy who sells me my morning coffee from time to time. And I asked him, I said, so Brian, what books, can you think of any books that have great trees in them? And he was like, well, I'm not sure, but, you know, I'll tweet you when I think of a couple of books. And so he did. And he said, can't find a quote online, but there are a lot of good scenes with Cal and Abra under the willow tree in East of Eden. So I went to look up East of Eden and did indeed find this willow tree goes throughout. And this is sort of how the show gets made from time to time, how my brain works. So I'm reading this thing and it says, on the edge of the field stood a little pump house and a willow tree flourished beside it, fed by the overspill of water. The long skirts of the willow hung down nearly to the ground. Abra parted the switches like a curtain and went into the house of leaves made against the willow trunk by the sweeping branches. You could see out through the leaves, but inside it was sweetly protected and warm and safe. The afternoon sunlight came yellow through the aging leaves. And then this willow tree shows up many times, actually, in the course of East of Eden. But of course, what then happens is I'm thinking, willow trees, where have I heard about these willow trees before? And of course, I'm thinking, Shakespeare. So then I end up looking at Shakespeare and I'm like, yes, of course. And there's this great little speech by Olivia in Twelfth Night. And she says, why? Olivia says, why? What would you? And the answer is, make me a willow cabin at your gate and call upon my soul within the house. Write loyal cantons of contemned love and sing them loud even in the dead of night. Hallow your name in the reverberate hills and make the babbling gossip of the air cry out, Olivia. Oh, you should not rest between the elements of air and earth, but you should pity me. So I get to that, and then I look at this little footnote in my copy of Shakespeare, and it says about this willow cabin that it's an arbor of willow, and willow is the unhappy lover's tree. Mm. So it turns out willows are not so. And the same thing happens, of course, in Othello. And Desdemona has this whole song about the willow tree. So this show becomes very complicated to know what to bring, because you go from this one little idea about, there's trees. This book with a willow and there's some trees, and it just, you get deeper and deeper into it. And another book that he mentioned was a book called Wish Tree by Catherine Applegate. And this actually is in which the tree is, in fact, the narrator. It's a young adult book, or even younger than young adult, but it begins with the narration by the tree, and the tree is saying, it's hard to talk to trees. We're not big on chit-chat. That's not to say we can't do amazing things, things you'll probably never do. Cradle downy owlets, steady flimsy tree forts, photosynthesize. But talk to people? Not so much. And just try to get a tree to tell a good joke. Trees do talk to some folks. The ones we know, we can trust. We talk to daredevil squirrels. We talk to hardworking worms. We talk to flashy butterflies and bashful moths. Birds? They're delightful. Frogs? Grumpy, but good-hearted. Snakes? Terrible gossips. Trees? Never met a tree I didn't like. So, you know, to come then to this lovely book called Wish Tree by Catherine Applegate, which is narrated by a tree, a book I'd never heard about before starting to prepare for this radio show. It's really a fascinating path one takes every month getting to this moment.
866-999-4626 is our number for your suggestions of books on trees. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books on trees with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Dennis Minsky, naturalist on the Dolphin Whale Watch Tours and a member of the Provincetown Tree Advisory Group. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to suggest a book for our book list, which we will compile and have a link to that later on our website at capeandislands.org. You can also shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Dennis, what is next on your list?
Well, Jill brought up Steinbeck, so I'm going to be literary too. I've been on a Joseph Conrad kick this past year, and a book I try to read every year or so is Heart of Darkness. I'm not the first one to make this observation, but if you know the novel or if you know Apocalypse Now, it's about the power of nature, the backdrop of nature. At any rate, it's Africa, and the forest is every bit a character in the book. He writes, going up that river was like traveling back to the earliest beginnings of the world, when vegetation rioted on the earth and the big trees were king. A great silence, an impenetrable forest. Trees, trees, millions of trees, massive, immense, running up high. The earth seemed unearthly. A dumb immobility sat on the banks. The living trees, lashed together by the creepers in every living bush of the undergrowth, might have been changed into stone, even to the slenderest twig, to the lightest leaf. It was not sleeping. It seemed unnatural, like a state of trance. There was no sign on the face of nature of this amazing tale. The woods were unmoved like a mask, heavy like the door of a prison. They looked with their air of hidden knowledge, of patient expectation, of unapproachable silence. And, of course, the famous lines, the horror, the horror. It's a creepy book.
And let's talk to Amy, who's giving us a call from Dennis. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I am well. Fascinating subject. I'm going to go out and get some of these books. But one thing I feel obligated to mention to you is J.R.R. Tolkien has a number of tree motifs in The Lord of the Rings. There's the Mirkwood Forest. There's the Ents, who are these fascinating sort of tree beings and whatnot. So just to throw that out there for you, I'm a dedicated Tolkien fan, so I couldn't let it pass.
No, we're glad you called. Like we said, there's so we're never going to get to all the books
right,
on
and
trees.
He actually also wrote a book just on trees and leaves, which was had been in my pile at one
point.
But
you took it out, All right, Amy, thanks for that. We appreciate that. Tomar's calling from Vineyard Haven. Good morning.
Good morning. I had a Dawn's Redwood I had planted in Cumberland, Rhode Island, and it didn't thrive for a few years. When I went to California, I took some soil from under the giant Dawn's Redwood, brought it home and spread it around my tree. My tree started to grow like crazy. But now I have planted tamarind seeds, and I had one tamarind for about a year, but I just couldn't make it grow. And now I've got tamarinds growing in groups in the same pot, and they are so happy.
That speaks to, Dennis, what you were talking about, your first book there, The Hidden Life of Trees. Yeah. Tomar, thanks for sharing that. We appreciate that. So, there is something to that. Yeah, you were nodding as she was telling the story. All right, Kim is calling from Yarmouth. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning. I joined a few minutes late, so I don't know whether you mentioned this book or not. I, of course, am enjoying the show, as I always do. But The Barkskins by Annie Proulx. I don't know if you've mentioned that book yet, because that is...
I've got it.
Dennis is holding it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you look at it, unless you know her work or an avid reader, you might be afraid of it. It's so huge, but it is so engrossing. It begins, I believe, Dennis, you could correct me, because I often forget specific details, but in like the 1600s with two guys who come over from the Netherlands, and they're sort of indentured, and they're up sort of near Montreal, Quebec, and they have to start clearing the trees, and it's backbreaking work, and the Indians, the natives, are like, what are these crazy white people doing? You don't cut down trees and build houses, and it progresses down into Boston, and it follows the lives of these two men, and it is unbelievably brutal, harkening back to what you said about starting a life, you know, in the West. It's unbelievably brutal and comes all the way up to present day, and even at one point, because one of the men gets involved with the native population, with Indians, and his line, his descendants do much less well than the white people, And he winds up down, one of his defendants winds up down in the vineyard marrying a Wampanoag woman. So it's huge and stunning, and it's Annie Proulx. It's beautifully written. And you learn just by listening to reading a beautiful story, you learn what life was like and what we have done to our lands in the past. I mean, if you look at pictures of Cape Cod from the turn of the century, of the last century, and there are no trees anywhere because we were using them to burn and to build. We've done it in the past. I love that book.
I was like, Kim, you sound very passionate about it. So we really, I can hear it in your voice. Thank you for calling and suggesting that book. And Dennis, you want to say anything else about it?
No, I was going to talk about it, but I think she did a pretty good job.
I did
a very good job. I also have written down sprawling historical novel, brutality, and it really underscores the difference in attitude between the European attitude towards trees, which, by the way, they thought were limitless. There was no end to them. There's a quote about, and they're just going on and on, in the Native American, the foreword to the book, and then I think I'll let it go. By destroying pagan animism, Christianity made it possible to exploit nature in a mood of indifference to the feelings of natural objects. That's Lynn White Jr. So that's that is the theme of the book, that the Europeans just made a commodity out of these forests, whereas the Native Americans, who are also brutalized, had reverence for it. And you know who won. And also your reference to Cape Cod in the next book I'm going to talk about, if we get to it.
Go ahead and talk about it now.
Okay, that's the Eric Rutgow book called American Canopy. It's an amazing book about the history of deforestation, but he talks about 95% of New England was forested. When I did, we did a show on whales. There's a book called Cape Cod Shore Whaling, and in that, 1663, Nantucket passed the first regulations about over-harvesting of wood. All the way through 1711 for Barnstable, 1714, the province lands were created by the Mass General Court, because already in the early 18th century, the Cape was deforested, as was so much of the world. But there's so much to learn here. England was basically deforested by this time. They came over here. They were desperate for wood. Poor people were freezing. There was no fuel. And they needed these white pines, the famous white pines. We don't have the real good ones here, for masts. England was trying to regain its status as the main naval force. And these white pines were just so good. One of the reasons they lost the war with the colonists was they had substandard masts, because, of course, they couldn't get ours anymore. I learned so much in this book. Here's just a few people that are in here. Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Lewis and Clark, George Washington, John Chapman described, we're running out of time, he did wear a tin cap, and he wore a gunny sack with and he was barefoot, and he slept on the ground all year. Daniel Boone, James Fenimore Cooper, Muir, Weyerhaeuser, on and on and on. But they mentioned that the early settlers heated with wood. The houses were so poorly insulated, 90% of the heat went up the chimney. It didn't matter. They had so many trees. And then, as the population increased and became more literate, people wanted to read, and that created the demand for wood pulp. And again, the trees and I mean, I'm looking at paper. These books are made out of paper. So this is still going on, by the way, still going on. I could go on and on about this. This is a really fantastic book.
All right. Thank you. Jill.
Well, I've been thinking about a lot of novels that include trees in their themes. And just to mention a few, To Kill a Mockingbird has a really important tree in it. A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith has a really important tree. Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum has
those
a big tree
trees.
Scene in it. And one of the books that we just read recently with our book club is called Garden Spells, which has apple trees in it. And it has magical apple trees. And much of the book and much of the conversation about this book was about the tree as character in this novel, which is about a garden that's surrounded by a tall fence and tucked away behind a small house in a small town. And the tree has magic properties. And the tree, this apple tree, can basically tell you your future. So very interesting novel by Sarah Addison Allen called Garden Spells. And I have to mention W.S. Merwin, who has written so many beautiful poems about trees. Here's a bit of one called Trees. I'm looking at trees. They may be one of the things I will miss most from the earth, though many of the ones that I have seen already I cannot remember. And though I seldom embrace the ones I see and have never been able to speak with one, I listen to them tenderly. Their names have never touched them. They have stood round my sleep, and when it was forbidden to climb them, they have carried me in their branches. Mm-hmm. He not only has written lots and lots of beautiful books about trees, he also has dedicated over three decades of his life to preserving and regenerating native plants and palms on a 19-acre site in Maui, Hawaii. Mm-hmm. So, and there's a beautiful, in fact, documentary about him and saving those trees. So there are lots of fabulous books out there.
All right, got a couple minutes left, Dennis. What have you got?
Well, I have a book called Lab Girl by Hope Jaron. And she is a botanist, I guess you could say. I think she, this book is a description of her development, the genesis of a scientist, a very quirky book, very, very complicated person. But in between facts about her progression, there are descriptions of aspects of trees. I'll just two sentences. A seed is alive while it waits. Every acorn on the ground is just as alive as the 300-year-old oak tree that towers over it. Neither the tree nor the oak is growing. They're both just waiting. Their waiting differs, however, in that the seed is waiting to flourish while the tree is only waiting to die. Goes on and on. But this is an interesting book, and for any young person, woman especially, might be interested in Lab Girl.
All right. About a minute, Jill.
Okay. Well, Dennis said not to mention this, but I'm going to mention it, which before we went on air, it's John Fowle's essay on the tree. And I have to say, it is very esoteric. It is beautifully written, though. It got this incredible write-up when it came out in The New Yorker. It was originally published in 1979 and then reprinted in 2010. It's a book-length essay on the impenetrability of the natural world by the late British novelist John Fowle. Many of you know him from The French Lieutenant's Woman or The Magus. Fowle writes that in his childhood, slinking into trees was always slinking into heaven. Mm. And he has this very interesting discussion of the kind of fruit trees that his father grew and how the fruit trees of his father were not the wood and the trees that he wanted and desired. And it has become a sort of classic essay on trees and how trees are thought of. Is that about right, Dennis?
I think it's a very, very, very important book. Yeah. Very important.
And as The New Yorker wrote, his prose sings of the uncertainty, danger, and thrill that he has felt when alone in the winds. The tree is a book to be pondered.
All right. We will have a link to the books that we talked about this morning at our website a little bit later on today, capeandislands.org. Dennis Minsky and Jill Erickson, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.